you do not possess a certain quality. You're drawn to someone who possesses it in the extreme. In other words, a passive person will not be drawn to someone who is normally assertive, but someone who is equally split in the opposite direction, someone who is overly domineering. Sometimes you may be attracted to a bad thing. If you've always been the good person, you may be drawn to someone who embodies some sort of dark side. The dark side could be sexual, substance abuse, irresponsibility, or impulsivity. But whatever it is, the saint falls head over heels with the sinner. This explains the heartache of many parents of adolescent girls. The good girl from the good family falls for the bad boy. This common pattern occurs when you're not able to look at and integrate your own badness. You may feel ashamed that you are not perfect, and you don't want to face some of the aspects of your own soul that need to be addressed. Because of either external or internal demands that you be good, you don't open up and integrate the shadow sides of yourself and turn into a real person. You have a good-bad split inside that shows up by your being good but being attracted to the bad. The resolution for this is to become neither good nor bad in a split way, but real, with both good and bad parts. See Luke 11:39-40 and Ecclesiastes 7:16-18. If you can find safe, healing relationships to integrate the parts of yourself you are ashamed of, you won't be drawn to darkness on the outside. Sometimes you may have a pain or hurt that you have never faced. Someone with unresolved hurt can be attracted to a person with a lot of pain and problems as a way of connecting with his own angst. This is the classic codependent syndrome. Whatever the issue, there are countless people who have denied parts of themselves and are drawn to problematic situations as an attempt to work out those issues. As Proverbs 4:23 says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life." Whatever is in your heart is what you are going to find yourself dealing with in one way or another. Guard your heart and make it healthy so you will not be attracted to the wrong kinds of people. Defensive hope. Have you had a lot of disappointment and loss in your life? If so, it may be difficult for you to let go of things, even things that are not good. You may have unknowingly developed a character pattern of defensive hope. You hope for things to change as a defense against the loss of letting them go, for the grief of letting go would be overwhelming to you. Seeing that a person is not going to be what you need long term, you will hang on to hope for change instead of going through the pain of loss. Romanticizing. Do you describe yourself as a hopeless romantic? If so, you may be vulnerable to charmers who can draw you into romantic kinds of dynamics, but without the underlying character to carry on a lasting relationship. As the Bible says, charm is deceptive. Proverbs 31:30. Charmers and their prey are unable to get past romanticization to real intimacy. Many sexual or romance addicts fall into this category. The romantic drama and sexual energy of the relationship distract them from the underlying emptiness of a relationship that's devoid of intimacy. As one woman told me, we were taking our emptiness to the bedroom and mutually denying it. If you have a tendency to romanticize, then you might have a tendency to live in a world of fantasized relationship. This is sometimes fine in the beginning of a relationship, for a season, and in a limited way. Fantasy is often what some of attraction consists of. But if a relationship cannot go past fantasy into sustained intimacy and real connection, the whole thing is a sham, and your emptiness must be faced. We're not saying that romance, sexuality, and passion are bad. On the contrary, they're absolutely essential. If you spend a lot of time with a growing relationship and never feel any passion or sexual attraction, then either something is wrong or this person really is someone that you should keep in the friend category. Sexuality and intimacy must come together for a relationship to be deep and fulfilling. Sex is part of God's design for erotic love in marriage, and must be developed as well as platonic love, connectedness, and friendship. But passion without character, intimacy, and friendship to undergird it is extremely dangerous. If you're a romantic, you may have a long-standing Cinderella complex, or your fantasies may be a defense against depression or other kinds of disappointments. But as wonderful as romance is, if it is not based on the reality of someone's character, it's going to be heartbreaking in the end. If you are a romantic by style or necessity, keep the good aspect of that, but work through the ways that it may be keeping you from facing some realities. The old whining and dining dynamic that lures people in is not a long-term basis for relationship. Friendship is. In fact, the better path is where real connection and friendship is the beginning, and romance grows from that. More about that later. But for now, remember that if you have a tendency to romanticize everything, then you're avoiding the reality of what is going on. And the reality is what you're going to have to live with. Undeveloped intimacy. Some people have not ever been connected with and known at a very deep level. At their most vulnerable parts of their heart, they have never been related to, so they don't really know what real connection and intimacy is. They might have come from a disconnected family or church background. Whatever the case, they don't even know what they're missing. If this is your experience, you will likely be drawn to people who cannot connect either. Detachment often is drawn to detachment for reasons of familiarity as well as the safety of remaining unknown. It's as if you say to your date, "You seem to be the same as me. Let's be disconnected together." Or you just do not know better, but the end result is that you're attracted to a disconnected character and fall in love as the fantasy life takes over from the disconnected part of yourself. The cure for disconnection is to make sure that you are in healing relationships that are not romantic in nature so that all of your parts can be related to and find connection. Then you will have developed the capacity for intimacy and being known at all levels, and you'll choose people who can know you at those levels as well. Friendship is the path. Romance is great. Sexuality is great. Attraction is great. But here is the key. If all of those are not built upon lasting friendship and respect for the person's character, something is wrong. A real and lasting relationship must be built upon friendship first. You're going to spend a lot of time with that person. As one friend of mine said about picking her mate, "He was someone I knew I could grow old with. I liked spending time with him, and he made me laugh." She also shared deep spiritual values and other commonalities with him as well, as she would with any other friend. They have been married for nearly 30 years. The best boundary that you can have in your dating life is to begin every relationship with an eye toward friendship. Do not rush into any kind of romance. Keep your boundaries, physically, emotionally, and otherwise. Spend time with a person. Spend time getting to know them in non-romantic ways. Spend time with that person in groups of other friends. How well does he or she fit in? How well do you fit in with his or her friends? Does he or she even have friends? If they do not have long-term friendships, that's a bad sign. If you don't allow yourself to rush into falling for someone that you have not become friends with first, you'll be more sure when you let yourself go to the next step. Certainly, you might find yourself having all sorts of feelings. Enjoy them, but do not believe them. Only believe your experience of getting to know a person and seeing if you can share at a deep level. See if you find that he or she is a person of the kind of character you would trust as a friend. And as important as all of that, see if that person is a person that you would like spending time with if there were no romance at all. That is the one true measure of a friend, a person with whom you like to spend time, having no regard to how you are spending it. Hanging out is fulfilling in and of itself, and that, long-term, requires character and, in the deepest of friendships, shared values as well. You would want your best friends to be honest, faithful, deep, spiritual, responsible, connecting, growing, loving, and the like. Make sure that those qualities are also present in the person you are falling in love with. Keep your boundaries. We guarantee that being lovers with someone you would not want to be friends with is no good thing at all. Takeaway tips. If you find that you're not really friends with someone you have a crush on, let that be a warning signal that something is wrong. Don't think that someone who has no character is going to develop it just because you want him or her to grow. If being attracted to the wrong person is a pattern, don't blame it on external reasons, but take responsibility for being the one who has a problem and work on finding its cause. Make yourself face the hard questions about the person you're with. With the help of friends, be honest about whether or not you really like the person as well as have chemistry with him or her. Romantic feelings can be very deceptive and even pathological. They are not true love. Friendship and shared values are the things that last in a relationship. Don't believe your romantic feelings. Romance is great. Sexuality is great. Attraction is great. But here is the key. If all of those are not built upon lasting friendship and respect of that person's character, something is wrong. Friendship should always be an underlying foundation of any romantic relationship. Romance is fleeting and comes and goes. Friendship lasts. Both are important in a lasting relationship. Chapter 8. Don't ruin a friendship out of loneliness. Recently, I, Dr. Townsend, attended a friend's wedding. Ellen had wanted to marry for a long time, and God brought Jeff and her together in a meaningful way. The wedding celebrated the union of a couple that truly seemed right for each other. During the reception, several toasts were made. One was from Ted, who has been best friends with Ellen since junior high school. He congratulated the couple and wished them the best. At the same time, it was obvious that he had some sadness also. He was still single and experienced some pangs of loss that his relationship with Ellen was going to have to change somewhat. She would not be as available to Ted as she had been before she married Jeff, a reality that they both accepted as being a good thing. Yet it was still painful for Ted. I have known these two friends for a long time, and I empathized with Ted. I remembered that over the years they knew each other, they seemed so compatible and happy together. Several people had suggested, "You two are really right for each other. Why don't you date?" Finally, they did try to date. But for both of them, the experience was like, as the saying goes, kissing your sister or brother. The romantic part of the connection simply did not exist. That sort of closeness even seemed to confuse the friendship feelings that they had had for each other. So the two figured that they were a safe harbor for each other and kept things platonic. The relationship was very satisfying and fulfilling for both. Each had an opposite-sex friend who gave them the unique support and perspective which same-sex friends can't provide. Ted and Ellen's friendship is an example of two things. First, it illustrates how much good can come from healthy opposite-sex relationships. And second, it shows how much grief they spared themselves by not pursuing a romantic relationship when the feelings were simply not there. And that's the topic of this chapter, helping you experience the good that comes from friendships and avoid the problems that come from making friendships into something they are not. Romanticizing a friendship. Romantic feelings come from an idealization of the other person. In our heads, we believe our beloved is perfect and experience all sorts of strong feelings, such as intense longings to be with him, admiration, and sexual desire. This idealization can be caused by several things, both healthy and unhealthy. 1. In a new relationship, you don't know much about the other person. Idealization fills in the gaps with good things in order to keep the couple involved in the relationship and helps them tolerate the early parts of the developing connection. 2. In a mature relationship, romantic idealization waxes and wanes through the connection at various times. It arises out of a deep appreciation and gratitude for the person's presence and love, yet it retains the reality of who he is at the same time. 3. In a struggling relationship, one person can develop romantic feelings for the other out of his own neediness. This neediness becomes romanticized, that is, it disguises its true nature in romance. The person feels alive, driven, and motivated to be with the other. Yet, the need is generally caused by some emptiness inside. It is this third cause that can ruin a perfectly good friendship. How do dependent feelings turn into romantic ones? Romanticization occurs when a lonely person is unable to safely feel and act appropriately upon his lonely emotions. Actually, loneliness is a good thing in and of itself. It's a signal that we need something from the outside, be it comfort, support, or empathy. It keeps us from starving emotionally. God has designed us to respond to that signal. If you're hungry, go get a burger. If you're lonely, go get plugged into a relationship. It's not all that simple, but that's the essential idea. However, many people have difficulty here. For some reason or another, their God-given need for relationship becomes distorted into something that makes them and their friends pretty miserable. They may have a history of attempting to turn friendships into something more, or they may have this happen only once or twice in life. The words that cut them the deepest are the kindly intended, "I really like you as a friend." Actually, there are two types of loneliness. The first is the type that indicates that we need to be in day-to-day contact with others. Relationship is an ongoing process. We need pretty constant refills of support and presence from others to keep us going. For example, a salesman who goes off on a long business trip feels lonely for his support network while on the road and takes steps to reconnect when he returns. A second type describes a problem condition. This type of loneliness is a chronic, long-standing sense of emptiness in life, no matter what the circumstances. The person can be around many loving, caring people and still feel isolated. She may either feel that others don't care or that she's unable to receive what they give. This loneliness is an indication that something is broken in one's soul and needs to be repaired in God's healing process. Whatever type of loneliness people experience, there are several causes of romanticization. Conflicts in experiencing dependency. People who romanticize often are unable to feel their dependency for what it is, dependency. Dependency is actually a blessed state. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Matthew 5:6. That's a good thing. For when we respond to it, God fills us up with the good things we need. Yet many people's dependent feelings are cut off. They're unable to experience loneliness as loneliness, emptiness as emptiness, relational hunger as relational hunger. There is good reason for this. While loneliness is a good, God-given emotion, it's not always a pleasant one. It indicates a state of deprivation, need, and incompleteness. Feeling deprived can be very painful, and we often try to deny what is painful in order to stay away from the feeling. Here are some reasons people are unable to feel their hunger. They may fear the depth of their internal emptiness. They may feel badness associated with loneliness. People who have had angry and detached relationships often have intense feelings of badness. They may feel ashamed of being needy. They may be afraid to risk reaching out for fear of being hurt. They may feel helpless and powerless when they feel their needs. As a result, lonely people may not feel like lonely people should, which is lonely. However, they may feel other things instead, such as irritation, depression, addictive drives, and romantic cravings. These are often far more acceptable and tolerable. The problem is, however, that acting on these false feelings does not meet the real needs for compassion, care, and comfort. If you have ever had an addiction or dated someone with one, you understand how the substance often slakes some desires but actually helps keep the person disconnected from the life of relationship. Still, other people may be able to experience their loneliness, but they are in conflict with it. They don't deny their loneliness, but they certainly don't see it as a good thing. Their neediness is painful and unpleasant, so they don't act on it. For example, a friend of mine once told me, "I date women that I'm not really excited about, so that I don't have to take a risk. I just hate that sense of wanting someone who might not want me." Failures in relating to the same sex. Often, those who romanticize their friends have a history of not being able to safely and deeply connect to the same sex. They may feel many negative things about those of the same sex. Worried that they will hurt the other person. Doubt that they have anything to offer. Contempt for the stereotypical weaknesses of their gender. Fear that they will lose opposite-sex opportunities by spending time with same-sex friendships. Yet, they may feel just the opposite with opposite-sex relationships. They will feel energized, charged up, and alive after a good romantic encounter. Often, these people have experienced problems in the past with same-sex relationships. For example, a woman may have had a distant, controlling, or enmeshing mother, and therefore overconnected to her father to get her needs met. Or she may have had a seductive father who attempted to get in between her and her mother's connection. Whatever the cause, the dependency needs that should be met in healthy, same-sex ways are being acted out in the romantic sphere. Romantic feelings are ultimately for adults. They're a way to prepare us for one of the most adult processes in life, which is marriage. The needs that romanticizers have are pre-adult needs, such as for belonging, being safe, and feeling comforted and loved. These needs are to be met primarily with God and your safe, non-romantic relationships. Keep these relationships a major part of your life. It will help you go for romance from a full adult perspective, not that of a lonely child. If you have had a friend with this struggle, you may have noticed that you are sort of a bus stop for him. When he is between girlfriends, he wants to spend all sorts of time with you. But when he finds someone, you don't hear from him for a long time. You're on the bus stop bench, and he's just hopped the romanticizing bus for another tour. Idealizing romance. Related to this is the problem of thinking that romance is the highest form of friendship. Many people who are into romance, watch out for anyone who tells you that, feel that friendship is a grade lower than a romance. Thus, they will attempt to develop romantic feelings with someone that they're friends with, believing they're taking the friendship to a better and deeper level. I had a friend tell me that she did this several times with high school and college friends. They thought, "We're so close, there must be romance here." Luckily, as she related to me, "We backed off, even though at the time we thought we were missing the higher road. Now, in our 30s, we're married to other people, and we're all glad about it." Romantic relationships are not better than friendships. They are different and meet different needs. Don't get caught in the idea that you are missing out by keeping your friend as only your friend. Rescue and caretaking roles. Sometimes, people who get caught up in romanticizing have tendencies to get into certain ways of relating, called rescuing and caretaking. The rescuee will signal a need for someone to take care of him. The caretaker will receive the signal and go support, comfort, or solve the problems of the rescuee. This sort of relationship has to do with people's struggles in directly taking responsibility for their lives, or in being able to receive rather than give. This sort of pattern becomes easily romanticized on both sides. The rescuee asks for a parent to protect him and falls in love with that parent. The caretaker looks for someone to fix and then falls in love with a grateful child. You see rescuing and caretaking played out in many ways in the world of dating. The man who has been wounded by so many women. The woman who believes that her love can repair that hurt man. The woman who can't get her finances and career together. The man who thinks he can get her on her feet. If you play this game, one of you is taking a child role. And while it may feel warm and loving now, remember that children one day grow up. They will struggle for their freedom and autonomy. It's not pleasant to be married to someone who thinks you're their controlling parent. Impulsiveness. Some people struggle with romanticization because they have difficulty with their drives and impulses. They become sexually intimate, an oxymoron, very quickly, or are into quick, intense, deep connections. They thirst for the experience of romance as it makes them feel vibrant and alive. A friendship feels like vanilla pudding, but in a romance, they can let out all sorts of loving and aggressive feelings and behaviors. It's as if romance is the place they can let it all hang out. The problem here is that impulses are to be matured and structured in healthy ways, not simply acted on when they tell us to. That's the essence of self-control. Impulsive romanticization is an ineffective shortcut to the truly higher road of deep, satisfying relationships. Learn to verbalize, express, and deal with your strong impulses in ways that bring healthy connection, not a history of intense and broken connections. How can I know if this is a friendship or a romance? But how can you tell if your present relationship is the real thing, or is one you've created to keep you out of your loneliness? Do you have to kiss your sister with every friendship to test it out? These are important questions, whether you're on the curative or preventive end of things. Here are some ways to see if you're wrecking a friendship by romanticizing. Get connected outside of the relationship. We all need people who will love us, support us, and tell us the truth on a continual basis. This provides an emotional foundation that helps keep relationships in perspective for what they truly are. So many people we have asked about their dating tragedies have told us, "I have always been lonely and moved too fast." Or, "I had just gotten out of a bad marriage and was so alone." The need to be connected with others cannot be overemphasized. In fact, it's almost impossible for you to follow the remaining suggestions here until you are first connected to others, because your deep needs for relationship can distort your thinking and objectivity. So drop this book for a week and start finding some safe places where you can also relate without a date. Evaluate the fruits of the relationship. What do you value in the relationship? True romance and romanticization are after very different goals. Here are some suggestions that will help you find out. In a healthy romance, desire is based on first being rooted in love elsewhere. In a romanticized friendship, desire is based on empty neediness for the other person. In a healthy romance, others' freedom is valued. In a romanticized friendship, others' freedom is a problem. In a healthy romance, relationship draws in friends. In a romanticized friendship, relationship shuts others out. In a healthy romance, conflicts work out okay. In a romanticized friendship, conflicts threaten the relationship. In a healthy romance, the couple has mutual feelings. In a romanticized friendship, one person feels romantic, the other doesn't. In a healthy romance, friendship and romantic feelings coexist. A romanticized friendship is comprised of all friend or all romantic feelings. It can't be both at the same time. As you can see, sooner or later, romanticization should break down the relationship if you're engaging in it unawares. A romanticized friendship will not meet the needs that romantic love should meet. It's a very good thing to find that out before marriage. Get feedback. Ask your friends if you are a romance addict, if they have ever sat on the bus stop bench waiting for you between relationships, or if they have ever felt used or neglected by you, they may have a good answer for you. Ask them to evaluate you as a friend. Ask if they know the deeper parts of who you are. Find out where you are emotionally invested in the lives of others. If you are on the receiving end. Natalie and Spencer had been dating several months. She had been very attracted to his friendliness, fun attitude, and values. Spencer had recently come off a painful breakup with a girlfriend. At first, Natalie had been concerned about a rebound effect. However, he seemed to be so into the relationship that she stopped worrying. They were having a great time. Recently, Natalie had begun worrying again. Spencer seemed to want more time and commitment than she was ready to give. He wanted to know where she was all the time. Worse, when they were together, all he wanted to do was cling to her and have her listen to him complain about his problems. She felt more like a mom than a woman who is being pursued by a man. They dated several more months like this because Natalie didn't want to hurt Spencer. She often enjoyed the relationship, and he helped her own loneliness. Finally, they started talking about her feelings. It turned out that Natalie had reason to be concerned. Spencer owned up to the problem. He told her, "I just need someone to care about. When I don't have that special person, I can't stand the emptiness." Natalie was relieved, as she was able to understand her experience better. The relationship ultimately did not last. However, Spencer subsequently got into a support group to help him resolve his dependency, rather than going to another serial relationship. And Natalie found someone who wanted a companion, not a parent. If you identify with Natalie's experience, it helps to see yourself as part of the problem. Natalie enjoyed Spencer's presence. However, she waited a long time to admit to herself that she was dating a lonely man with whom she would have been better off in a friendship. She did this because she enjoyed his attentiveness. She didn't want to hurt him, and because she was also a lonely person. You may find yourself in the same boat. You're doing yourself and your date no favors by avoiding the reality. Early childhood feelings and parts of ourselves will ultimately cause some problems in a grown-up dating relationship, if they have no other relationships in which to be healed and matured. Pay attention to things like openness, freedom, mutuality, and the like. If you avoid the issues, you can keep a lonely person from ever dealing with a problem that God wants to help him with, and you can waste a lot of your time and energy. Be part of the solution for both of you. Takeaway tips. Explore your loneliness to see if it is the normal need for connectedness or a sign of an injury that needs to be healed. Be aware that romantic feelings, though a good thing, can disguise deep loneliness and confuse how you pick people. Become deeply involved in your friendships and value the good things you're getting out of them. This can fulfill you inside and help resolve the tendency to romanticize platonic relationships. Don't be afraid of dependent feelings. Use them to seek out good people. Stay in touch with safe and truthful friends who can help you see when you create something in a relationship that isn't there. Chapter 9. Beware when opposites attract. He is so strong and I'm so insecure. She's a people person and I'm into my own space. He's good at making money and I'm good at spending it. She's confident and I need reassurance. He's everything I'm not. He completes me. Completion. At our deepest part, we all want and need it. To be complete is to become whole, without deficit or undivided. At some level, most of us are aware that we do not possess completion, that we are unfinished and not what we should be. Yet there is within us a God-given desire to find the missing pieces that will finish us. This desire drives us toward relationships and experiences that will help us attain completion. Yet, as we will see, this desire can also be confused with the desires of dating and mating, and bad things can happen. This is the problem of the opposite attract mentality. The thinking is that you bring to the table certain qualities, and your date brings the opposite qualities. The result of your relationship is that you both end up better off. The sum is greater than the parts. For example, you may be a careful but sometimes indecisive person. You fall in love with a guy who knows what he wants and goes for it. You may think, "What a good fit. He can help me learn to know what I want and go after it." Differing gifts are good for relationships. Indeed, there is a lot of value in people bringing strengths to a relationship, as no one is Superman. Our lives are always enriched by being connected to others who have abilities we don't have. Any business person will tell you that job descriptions and training are quite individual. You want your analytical, detail-oriented people in accounting and your creative brainstorming people in marketing. The same is true in the church. The Bible teaches that we all have different gifts or abilities that we bring to our relationships and the world. There are different kinds of gifts, but the same Spirit. 1 Corinthians 12:4. Some are more talented in administration, while others bring teaching abilities to the body of Christ. No believer is self-sufficient. The idea of complementary gifts and strengths is good for us emotionally in more than one way. We have to learn humility to ask people for what we don't possess, and that helps us grow. For example, if your date is perceptive in relationships, you might ask him why you are struggling in your relationship with your roommate. In addition, we also can grow from the competencies of others. When my son Ricky wanted to sign up for organized basketball, I wanted to help coach him, but I didn't know much about the sport. So I called Dan, a friend who knows the game, and whose son Zach is a friend of Ricky's. We decided to co-coach a team that included our sons, with Dan as head coach and me as assistant. Though I'm not gifted in the way Dan is in basketball, I learned so much about the sport that season. So we're enriched and helped by taking advantage of the differing gifts of others. The problem of opposite attractions. We should use and appreciate the abilities of those who have what we don't. However, the danger occurs when we make opposing styles or abilities a basis for relationship. At the outset of the relationship, this may seem like a good thing. You are completing each other. You each provide what the other needs. You're stimulated by the other's different point of view. However, the danger of going for an opposite type person is this. Opposite-driven relationships often confuse dependency with true love. That is, people may feel intense longings and attractions for an opposite person. They may appreciate the completion they feel with that person. But they run the risk of simply needing that person for those functions and never giving the true loving feelings any relationship needs to grow and flourish. Dependency is only part of love. It's not the full expression of love. The full expression of love is to give back from a full heart. For example, Lindsay was more of a lover than a fighter. She was good at caring and connecting with others, but she had a hard time with assertiveness and conflict. It seemed she often ended up having to put up with maltreatment or inconsiderateness from others. She was a nice person, and therefore a magnet for irresponsible persons. Lindsay started dating Alex, who was her opposite in this area. Alex was strong, confident, and had no problems entering into conflict for what he believed was right. He had clear moral and spiritual values, was successful in his career, and took initiative to solve his problems. Lindsay was attracted to Alex's strength. She was even more smitten when it helped her own life. For example, Lindsay's apartment manager neglected to have an electrical wiring problem repaired after she had made several requests. She mentioned the problem to Alex over dinner. The next day, he had called her manager. Lindsay never found out what he said to him, but the wiring was fixed within 24 hours. She was elated, grateful, and even more attracted to Alex. He certainly had other good qualities, such as being caring, responsible, and funny. but she felt a lot of relief when she encountered conflicts that Alex would handle for her. The relationship continued to grow and deepen. However, Lindsay began relying more and more on Alex to enter into conflict that she felt ill-equipped to deal with. He negotiated with her garage mechanic over problems with her car. He talked to her boss about her weekend work hours. He even confronted her mother on how she used guilt to get Lindsay to make inopportune visits. Finally, the confrontational Alex sat Lindsay down for their own confrontation. He explained, "I really love you, but I'm starting to feel some resentment. I don't mind helping you, it makes me feel useful, but with some of these relationships you are afraid of dealing with, I'm feeling more used than useful." Lindsay understood what Alex was saying. She had been utilizing the opposite thinking mentality to keep from working on her own growth, specifically her fear of conflict, anger, and arguments. She agreed that she had been using Alex without realizing it, and she began working on assertiveness in her support group at church. She told him, "Let me know the next time I ask you to do my dirty work for me." Alex appreciated her attitude. This story ends well, as the two eventually married and are happy together. But the problem could have resolved in many different ways. Alex could have quietly resented Lindsay, and the relationship could have disintegrated. Lindsay could have disagreed with Alex, thinking it was his job in the relationship to solve these problems. Alex could have used his confrontation abilities to control and manipulate her in the relationship. Lindsay could have despaired at her inability to stand up for herself. Lindsay could have resented Alex's abilities and seen him as domineering instead of working on becoming more assertive herself. Had Lindsay not been a growing type person, she may have remained conflict avoidant, always looking to Alex to do that which she was afraid or unwilling to do. Why opposites attract. The phrase opposites attract does have some truth to it. Opposites are drawn to each other in many styles: extroverts and introverts, analytic and visionary, high energy and laid back, thinking and feeling, disciplined and spontaneous, relationship seeking and shy, confident and insecure, self-absorbed and giving, critical and accepting. What is it about opposites that people find so attractive? Why are we attracted to our opposite? There are several answers to this question. We do not want to work at developing ourselves. Often, we date and want opposite people because we do not want to do the work of developing for ourselves what the other person does well. Whatever her opposite trait is, it appears easier to appreciate, admire, and use hers rather than to grow in that area. It's a matter of not taking ownership of what we need to repair or develop in our character. In this example, Lindsay initially was happy to let Alex do her confronting for her. She felt safe, relieved, and protected. She hadn't realized yet that she was neglecting an area of growth that she needed to work on. And that's the essence of the opposite issue. It's not really about the other person. It's about using another person to avoid dealing with our own souls. When we decide to stop piggybacking on someone else's strengths, they are not the problem. We are. And growth can begin. We want to be complete. One reason people are initially drawn to an individual with opposite traits is a pretty healthy one. It's that we are drawn to those who possess what we do not, so that we can internalize and own that trait for ourselves. This is a good thing, as that is how God designed the growth process. We are to receive training in life from others, then pass our knowledge and abilities down to others over the generations for their own benefit. Therefore, suppose you are a type A person who is dating an emotionally driven person. You might be attracted to his feeling responses to life because it's a part of growth that you want to develop in yourself. He's more developed in that area than you, and so may have something to offer. This is a good thing. Though this really is how we grow, dating is not a good arena in which to develop oneself in a specific and important aspect of growth. Though your date may be a good supportive example, he is still a date, not a mentor, teacher, or counselor to you. Also, since dating is not a permanent commitment, you run a risk that you will lose that person's benefits to you. It's much better to go to non-dating relationships in order to mature and grow with the tutelage of others who have what you are working on possessing. We are afraid of dealing with our deficits. Another reason that opposites attract is our fear of looking at our own character flaws. Self-exploration and change can be scary. We may be afraid of dealing with our inability or weakness in several aspects. Making mistakes and failing. Risking making others angry. Having others leave us. Guilt over hurting others. Re-experiencing a painful past. Looking at parts of ourselves that we don't like to see. Lindsay's issue with Alex was fear-based. She was not an irresponsible person, but she had come from a family in which being polite, nice, and compliant were seen as virtues, while honesty, confrontation, and limit-setting were seen as selfish sins. She had grown up believing that telling the truth was hurtful, and she hated conflict. So she was terrified of dealing with problems with people. We are spiritually lazy. Irresponsibility is the other side of the coin. It's simply easier to have others do for us what we don't want to do for ourselves. This is the nature of immaturity, or spiritual laziness. Actually, life does begin with others doing for us. Infants are dependent on mothers to do virtually everything. Babies have very little of what they need to survive inside of them. They learn how to take in from the outside that which they don't possess. The Bible illustrates this process. Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation. 1 Peter 2:2. But this isn't irresponsible behavior for an infant. It's his task. God designed him so that as he takes in love, support, safety, care, instruction, and discipline, he internalizes these things and develops them for himself. What was once outside of us now becomes part of us. Immaturity, however, is when a person fails to take ownership for what he has internalized and continues to demand that others provide it for him. The rageaholic has to have his girlfriend soothe him when he is angry, rather than learning to self-soothe and deal with his rage. The impulsive Nordstrom's shopper depends on her boyfriend to sort out her tangled finances. The introverted man looks to his girlfriend to maintain the relationships he should be developing. This is not appreciating someone's strengths. Instead, one person is not taking stewardship of his life, and the other is taking too much stewardship of that same life. So whether the problem be fear or laziness, we need to deal with our own deficits instead of looking to a date to heal them. We rely on our partner's gifts rather than dealing with our character deficits. Sometimes the problem can be a confusion between giftedness and character deficits. A woman may think her boyfriend is simply more gifted in decision-making and finances than she is, and hands over that part of her life to him. Though he may be more gifted, competent, or trained, that's not the issue. We're all to carry our own load in life. While we are to go to others for help in areas, we're still to take ownership of our lives. If you find yourself continually needing to go to your date for things you should be doing for yourself, you may be confusing giftedness with character issues. What would a dating relationship look like in which giftedness and ability were appreciated, but the two people were still taking ownership of their lives? There are a few indications. 1. Each person is dealing with his own problems as his. They aren't the other's. It isn't the other's failure if we fail in an area we aren't strong in. 2. Both members love and appreciate the gifts of the other person. However, They see the other's gifts as gifts, not as necessities to the relationship. 3. Each member is actively involved in pursuing spiritual completion and growth in his areas of weakness, not content to let the other do the work in that area. What happens when oppositeness rules? Though opposites do attract, they can have their dangers as well. To illustrate the problems involved when opposites attract, we'll use the example of Kim and Pete, a couple who dated for about a year. Their struggles will show what kinds of problems occur when oppositeness rules. Kim always found it hard to relate to people. She had difficulty opening up to or trusting others. She began dating Pete, who had never met a stranger. People were always hanging around Pete, who seemed to naturally put people at ease with a smile or a question. Kim loved being with Pete, not only because she was attracted to him, but because good things happened when he was around. All of a sudden, Kim found herself having lots of friends due to her association with her opposite, Pete. They became a popular couple in their circles. Church events, parties, and sports events became a wonderful part of her life. Then, over the next few months, several things happened to the couple. Loss of freedom. First, Kim began realizing that she had to schedule her life around Pete. When he wasn't around, she couldn't engage with others as freely because the chemistry wasn't there. So, for Kim to have people in her life, she had to follow Pete around. She began losing freedom and control in her time and schedule. When you depend on another person for what you should be developing, you no longer have control or freedom in that aspect of your life. It now belongs to the other person. Even if it's a good person who loves you, it is not you. God has designed you to make free choices in life. Galatians 5:1-2. When you are dependent on your date's oppositeness, you are no longer in charge. He has what you haven't developed, so you must give up freedom in order to get it from him. Resentment. Kim and Pete found themselves resenting each other. Kim felt like a puppy without a life of her own, and felt that Pete controlled her. She also envied his ease of relating to others. Pete, on the other hand, began to resent Kim for her dependency on him. He didn't like having, as he put it, to carry the social burden all the time. Though they cared for each other, these negative feelings began to get in the way of their relationship. Confusion in responsibilities. Kim began spending more and more of her life passively doing what Pete wanted. She began thinking her role in their relationship was to keep Pete happy, so he would keep her in social circles. The couple began a strange job share that married couples find themselves in. Kim stopped taking responsibility for her friendships and made Pete her project. Pete stopped taking responsibility for how he conducted his relationship with Kim. He knew she'd be around no matter what. Neither party was taking full ownership of their lives. Parent-child struggles. Kim started feeling like she was the child, and Pete the domineering parent. Since she desperately needed him around to maintain relationships, she would feel one down to him when they differed in social engagement areas. If she wanted to go to a church singles social and Pete wanted to go to a hockey game, they both knew she had more to lose than he did. Pete sometimes unfairly took advantage of his leverage, saying, "Well, you go to yours and I'll go to mine," knowing Kim would feel out of her element at the social without him. She felt he called the shots. Pete thought Kim was becoming pouty and immature, which is how parents often feel about a dependent child. The other aspect of the parent-child struggle is that kids are designed by God to one day leave home. Their dependency on their opposite parents, that is, people who have strengths that the children don't yet possess, should one day resolve. At that point, they go out on their own. This same reality happens in relationships, because the opposite issue is really about dependency. Ultimately, it ended Kim and Pete's connection. Kim began to work on her shyness and trust problems. She got into a support group and began taking risks and opening up to others. She encountered lots of fears, but in time, she began entering the world of relationships on her own. She actually found herself making friends of her own. No longer were Kim and Pete opposites. They were simply adults. Kim began feeling freer to disagree with Pete about events and schedules, as she was no longer afraid to be without him. She began going to events with or without him. And though he had resented Kim's dependency, Pete began resenting her independence more. Finally, the couple broke up. The parent-child stance they were in couldn't move into a grown-up mutual one. Dependency and growth. All this is not to say that we should not be dependent on each other. God created us to be dependent on Himself and others. He says that that is a good thing. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Ecclesiastes 4:10. If you have ever failed or fallen apart and had no one to help you get up, you know how empty that sort of life is. Dependency on the love and support of others is a good thing. But dependency has an ultimate purpose: growth. We are to take in the love, comfort, and instruction of others in order to grow spiritually and emotionally. The problem is that you can have a relationship that has dependency but no growth. The dependency is regressive. It keeps you or your date unformed emotionally. This is the problem of two opposites depending on the strengths of each other. Two people are close, supportive, and connected, but someone isn't doing the hard work of taking what they are given and working on their character and soul. Dependency that does not lead to growth ultimately creates more immaturity in the person. At some point, babies are weaned, kids are told to jump in the pool, and young adults learn to make moral and career decisions for themselves. Hugh and Sandy had been dating for a while. He was an organized business type. She was an artistic person with interests in painting, acting, and music. He was fascinated by her creativity. Sandy brightened up his otherwise predictable, left-brained life. For her, Hugh brought a stability and safety that she needed. Though they initially appreciated each other's strengths, they inadvertently and quickly began to depend on each other for their own deficits. Hugh stopped trying to be a more emotional and spontaneous person and left it to Sandy. In her stead, Sandy stopped trying to organize her life and let Hugh deal with it. As the relationship progressed, however, cracks began to show. Hugh began to resent having to deal with Sandy's financial crises, chronic scheduling problems, and career issues. He felt he was having to parent her. From Sandy's view, she resented having to be interesting to a dull, somewhat controlling person, and felt she was doing all the emotional giving in the relationship. They were both right. They were using dependency to serve immaturity, not growth. Opposites often depend on each other. That is not a problem, as long as that dependency spurs each member on to maturity and completeness. Opposites and maturity. In our experience, the degree of attraction that opposites have for each other is often diagnostic of the couple's maturity. In mature couples, opposite traits are simply not a major issue. The two people are not drawn to opposite traits due to their own deficits. They're drawn to values that they share, such as love, responsibility, forgiveness, honesty, and spirituality. Attraction based on values is much more mature than attraction based on what you don't have inside. On the other hand, immature couples seem to struggle more with finding someone who possesses the nurturance, structure, competence, or personality that they don't. They go through painful cycles of idealizing the other person, getting closer, developing a dependency on the other person, making a parent out of them, then having horrible breakups, only to look for someone again with those opposite traits. Ultimately, many are looking for a parent to take care of part of them that they aren't taking care of in themselves. Differences can help make a good relationship fulfilling, rich, and satisfying. Each partner appreciates the talent and unique points of view of the other and falls more deeply in love with that person. The couple becomes part of the wonder of love, that two people who are so opposite can connect so well and become truly one. My father, who has been married for 50 years to my mother, is very different from her. He likes playing jazz piano in the background for her while she sings. He still talks about how she can light up a room with her presence, while he enjoys being in the background. What he is actually saying, I think, is that she lights up not only the room, but also his own heart. And that is how opposites truly can attract, not as a basis for a relationship, but as a wonderful complement and addition to an already loving connection. So make oppositeness a non-issue. Look more for character, love, and values than who has what. Don't fall for an introvert simply because you are an extrovert. Fall for someone who calls you into love, growth, and God. And then,